Good afternoon. Welcome to the Heritage Foundation. I'm John Hilbold, and as Director of Lectures and Seminars, it's my pleasure to welcome you to our Lehrman Auditorium. We, of course, welcome those who are joining us via the internet at our heritage.org website, and remind our internet viewers that questions can be submitted via email to speaker@heritage.org, speaker@heritage.org. And as a final courtesy before we officially begin, would everyone please check that cell phones and pagers have been turned off? At the Heritage Foundation, we believe in the rule of law and traditional American values, and we seek to preserve and protect constitutional government. The unique compact given to us by our enlightened founders divided authorities to avoid the development of a single powerful tyranny. As we will discuss today, however, the judicial branch has assumed a role beyond that with which it was chartered. Hosting our program is Becky Norton Dunlop. Mrs. Dunlop is Vice President for External Relations here at the Heritage Foundation. She oversees our strategic outreach and communication, both nationally and internationally, to conservative public policy institutions, other leadership organizations, and policy activists. Prior to joining Heritage, she served as Secretary of Natural Resources for the Commonwealth of Virginia in the cabinet of Governor and now Senator George Allen. As a senior official in the Reagan administration, she served at the White House as Deputy Assistant to the President for Presidential Personnel and Special Assistant to the President and Director of his Cabinet Office. She became a Special Assistant to Attorney General Ed Meese and then served as Deputy Undersecretary of the Department of the Interior, as well as Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. She currently serves on the board for numerous public policy organizations and associations. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming my colleague, Becky Norton Dunlop.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Heritage Foundation. We're just delighted that you're here today for a very important presentation by a very important lady. It is really a pleasure for me to introduce our speaker today, Phyllis Schlafly. She has been a longtime heroine of mine and is a national political leader. You know, sometimes when I used to introduce Phyllis, I would introduce her as a national conservative leader, but she has transcended just the conservative movement. She is now known around the country as a political leader in a number of different areas. And she's been a national leader since the publication of her best-selling book in 1964, A Choice, Not an Echo. One of the first conservative books I ever read, and it still is on the shelf of my library. Mrs. Schlafly has a wonderful history. She is truly a unique woman. She worked her way through college on the night shift, firing rifles and machine guns to test 30 and 50 caliber ammunition for the government during World War II. The message of that little sentence is, be careful. You're dealing with a tough lady. She then received her master's degree from Harvard at age 20. After a lifetime as a volunteer in conservative politics, defeating the Equal Rights Amendment in a 10-year battle and being elected a delegate to almost every Republican National Convention since 1952, Phyllis graduated from Washington University Law School after she was age 50 and is now a member of the bar in Missouri, Illinois, Washington, D.C., and the United States Supreme Court. As president of Eagle Forum, she has filed many amicus briefs with the U.S. Supreme Court, including a brief in both the Ten Commandments cases, which are being argued this morning before the U.S. Supreme Court. In case there's any doubt, she's obviously on the side of the Ten Commandments. Mrs. Schlafly also served as a member of the Commission on the Bicentennial of the U.S. Constitution from 1985 to 1991, appointed by President Ronald Reagan. She has testified before more than 50 congressional and state legislative committees on constitutional, national defense, and family issues, and is one of the most effective grassroots political leaders in American history. She has received many honors, including being named one of the 100 most important women of the 20th century by Ladies Home Journal. She is the author or editor of more than 20 books on topics as diverse as family and feminism to national security. Her newest book, The Supremacists, The Tyranny of Judges and How to Stop It, is a handbook for citizen action in dealing with federal and state judges who are legislating from the bench. We are delighted to have Phyllis with us here at the Heritage Foundation today. I give you Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly.
Thank you very much, Becky, for those kind words, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Becky, the conservative movement has come a long way since you and I were working in the little holes in the wall and trying to get it started many years ago. So I'm very happy today to be here at Heritage. I appreciate Attorney General Ed Meese and a number of congressmen being in the audience on a very important subject. And today is quite an auspicious day to discuss the tyranny of activist judges. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing two cases on the Ten Commandments today. And yesterday's decision is a prime example of an activist judge legislating from the bench. I hope you all are indignant about the decision, about what the decision said, and about the way it was decided. One of the lines in George Bush's campaign speeches as he went around the country last year that didn't get a lot of publicity but always got a big hand was when he said, "We are not going to stand for activist judges who are legislating from the bench and trying to remake our culture through court order." And this is exactly what they're doing. In the case that was decided yesterday, Justice Kennedy simply rewrote a portion of the Constitution to say that we cannot execute people under age 18. Now, about half of the states have that rule, about half don't. It is a state legislative matter, and yet he relied on foreign sources, said that we are just one of the few countries that permit this. International law and the law of other countries rule otherwise. Therefore, we should accommodate ourselves to what international law is doing. And of course, in this particular case, it was a vicious murder for kicks. And we think that this was an activist judge legislating from the bench, the kind of thing that we do not believe should happen. Now, we're not critical of all judges. I like to say that we look upon judges very much like we should look upon baseball umpires. You cannot run a baseball game without an umpire. Somebody has to call the balls and strikes and the close calls. But if any umpire ever called a batter out after two strikes, you know the fans would not tolerate it because the umpire cannot change the rules of the game. But what we have is the judges have developed this idea that because they put on black robes, they now are supreme over the other branches of government. They now can overturn the will of the people. That's why I call them supremacists. A supremacist is somebody who thinks he can override the other branches of government and the will of the people. And that is what we should not stand for, as President Bush said. I would suggest to you that whatever your hot-button issue is, whatever is the issue that you care most about, it gets back to the judges being the problem. Take the matter of marriage. The laws of all 50 states and the federal law all say that marriage is between a man and a woman as husband and wife. And then along came these judges, four judges on the Massachusetts High Court, who said they're going to change it and order same-sex marriage licenses. Now, they pretended to be reinterpreting the Massachusetts State Constitution, which was written by John Adams and adopted in 1780. And any notion that John Adams wrote something that could be construed as approving same-sex marriage is just simply absurd. The judges said marriage is an evolving paradigm. So when the judges use words like that, you're sure they're getting into some territory that they shouldn't be in. The federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act, was passed in 1996 and signed by Bill Clinton, overwhelmingly passed. Incidentally, one of the few members of Congress who voted against it was John Kerry. But nevertheless, what we have is the gay rights movement has tried to get activist judges to do what they cannot get state legislatures and Congress to do. They tried this in Hawaii. They picked their first state a number of years ago. Hawaii was considered the most left-wing state. And their Supreme Court did say that they had to issue same-sex marriage licenses. And the people of Hawaii rose up and passed a constitutional amendment that said, no, you're not going to do that to us. And the same thing happened in Alaska. I don't know what happened to the fight of the men who marched at Concord and Lexington when they had this situation in Massachusetts. Somehow they turned into marshmallows. But the people have got to stand up and say that we are not going to accept this type of activist supremacist ruling as the law of the land. Take the matter of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Now, the text of the pledge was a law passed by Congress a half century ago, signed by the president. Millions of children have said the Pledge of Allegiance, and the American people are overwhelmingly in favor of this. A couple of years ago, some judges out on the left coast decided they just discovered this was unconstitutional. Now, when that got to the Supreme Court last year, the court ducked. My own feeling is they probably thought if they threw out the pledge, which they wanted to do, it might help to re-elect George Bush. So they ducked on a technicality. But it will come back because these cases are arising all over the country. Then there's the matter of prayer in the school. Now, it was in 1962 that the court threw out prayer in the school. It was a simple little prayer that was said in New York. Almighty God, we ask your blessings on ourselves, our teachers, and our parents. And they threw it out, and there was a big national uproar. But that uproar kind of petered out, and the court progressed with what Chief Justice Rehnquist has called its hostility to religion. So now we're at the situation where you can't have an invocation at graduation, and you can't say a prayer before a football game. Judge Bork once said, a nude dancing before a football game would be more constitutionally protected than a prayer. Of course, he said that before the wardrobe malfunction last year. We simply confirmed what he said. So it is true that the court bristles with hostility at all things religious. That's how we have these cases against the Ten Commandments. There are hundreds of Ten Commandments monuments and plaques in public places, in courts, courthouses, and public parks around the country. And I think the ACLU sees a pot of gold under every one of those monuments. When they win these cases, they're able to collect attorney's fees. When they got a judge to throw the Ten Commandments monument out of Montgomery, Alabama, they and their associates collected $500,000 from the taxpayers of Alabama. And, of course, they can just regurgitate all of these briefs and file them again for every one of these Ten Commandments cases. Take the matter of pornography. As Judge Bork said one time, the suffocating vulgarity of our current culture is in large measure due to the courts. Now, the courts didn't write the pornography. What they did was to dismantle all of our attempts to maintain some type of communities with decency regulations. This happened in our lifetime. It happened in the 1960s when the Irwin Court handed down a series of 34 decisions that completely turned the law of obscenity upside down. It overturned all the lower court convictions and the lower court laws and the prosecutions for obscenity. And these 34 decisions were handed down anonymously. They were opinions of the U.S. Supreme Court, but no justice dared to put his name on them. And they completely overturned the law. So this is why we have this suffocating vulgarity in movies, in books, in adult bookstores, in the internet, and everywhere else. It is the fault of those cases. And as the years went on, just like in the prayer cases, it went from bad to worse as more and more examples of acknowledgement of God began to be ruled against by the court. Likewise, more and more examples of outrageous pornography began to be approved by the court. And the court used the First Amendment to restrict religious and even political speech at the same time that it's wrapping the First Amendment around the pornographers. One of the most recent cases was a federal judge in the state of Washington who threw out a state law that put a fine on retailers who sell video games to teens to show them how to kill policemen. And the judge said, this is just as much entitled to First Amendment protection as fine literature. And then in the most recent case, a federal judge held that it is we, the taxpayers' job to provide pornography to prisoners. We had a very good law, the Ensign Amendment, to say that prisoners should not be provided with pornography, but the federal judge has now ruled they have their First Amendment rights to get pornography like anybody else, and of course that is at taxpayers' expense. You all, of course, are familiar with Roe v. Wade and how the court invented the new right of a woman to have her unborn child killed, a right that nobody else had ever seen in the 14th or 5th Amendments since those amendments were adopted by the Constitution. And then a few years later, the court came along in the Casey Amendment, and Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, and said we can't overturn Roe v. Wade because stare decisis, and it would interfere with the reputation for legitimacy that the court has if we change our opinion on this. In other words, we have to support an illegitimate decision in order to protect the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. That was their argument. Now, in the case yesterday, Justice Kennedy did overturn a very recent Supreme Court decision about capital punishment for minors. And in the Kennedy's other notorious case a few years ago, Lawrence v. Texas, which overturned the anti-sodomy law in Texas, they overturned a Supreme Court decision of just a few years earlier. So we have a very strong feminist streak now in the courts, and in particular in the Supreme Court, where we have two feminists with long feminist records on the U.S. Supreme Court, O'Connor and Ginsburg. It really is it is tragic that when Justice Ginsburg was up for confirmation, no senator dared to ask her about her extraordinary paper trail of radical feminism, which was all out there for anybody to see. In fact, they could have read excerpts from it in the Phyllis Schlafly report, but nobody asked her about it, even asked her about it when she was up for confirmation. And then she was the one who found, after 150 years, that there was something unconstitutional about Virginia Military Institute taking men as brother rats. Now she ordered they had to take women as brother rats also at VMI. You can track the same type of judicial activism in many other areas. You can track it in the criminal law. You can track it in education. You can track it in immigration. You can track it in the tax law. Do you know that there are now court cases pending in 24 of the 50 states asking activist judges to order the state legislature to put more money into public schools, which of course means raising taxes. If there is any task that should be a legislative function, it is raising taxes. And yet we find these judges are presuming to order the legislature to put more money into the schools, according to what the judge thinks ought to be done, and that, of course, means raising taxes. Another problem we have with these activist judges today is their citing of foreign authorities. There are now 6 of the 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices who have cited foreign authorities for some of their opinions. Justice Breyer said in dealing with capital punishment, we really ought to look to what they do in Zimbabwe. Do you know what goes on in Zimbabwe? I don't think we want to know what goes on in Zimbabwe. In the Lawrence v. Texas case, the anti-sodomy case of a couple of years ago, which is sometimes used by those who are trying to get the courts to give us same-sex marriage licenses, Justice Kennedy couldn't find anything in the U.S. Constitution to support his decision, so he cited the British Parliament and the European Court of Human Rights and some brief filed by some U.N. High Commissioner. I think this sort of thing is grounds for impeachment. They all took an oath to uphold and defend the U.S. Constitution, and they should not be citing foreign sources. And yet Justice O'Connor recently said that more and more they are going to be doing this. And they are running around to these foreign seminars where they get some of these bad ideas. In the case that was decided on capital punishment yesterday, they cited the United Nations Treaty on the Rights of the Child, which we have not ratified. And it's a terrible treaty, and we have successfully stopped the U.S. Senate from ever ratifying it, but here is a court case citing it anyway. And they cited also the U.N. Treaty on Civil and Political Rights, which unfortunately we did ratify, but when we did ratify, we put a reservation on that specifically exempted what we were going to do in regard to capital punishment for juveniles. So much for reservations to treaties. And anybody who thinks we can protect ourselves from the mischief of treaties such as the Law of the Sea by putting on a reservation, it doesn't work. And even the Supreme Court has now held that it didn't work. Now, when Judge Marshall on the Massachusetts High Court handed down her same-sex marriage decision, she didn't mention foreign sources. However, she is a South African, and her friends have talked before seminars and said that they can see South African law running through that opinion, as well as Canadian law. You know, Canadians have now gone for same-sex marriages. So this influence of foreign law is not something that we want. Over the years, really it got going with Justice Brennan a few years ago. They talked about our Constitution being a living and evolving document. You know, when they asked Al Gore what kind of judges he would appoint, he wants judges who believe in a living and evolving Constitution. Now, Great Britain has a living and evolving Constitution, and when our founding fathers wrote the Constitution, they said, no, that isn't what we want. We want to write it down in black and white so we know exactly what it means. And we can all read it and know what it means, and we don't need or want any justices to pretend that it's evolving or they've developed new paradigms so that they can write their own social policies into the law and create new rights that nobody else had ever seen in the law. Now, when you talk about some of these subjects, you will find that there'll be some lawyers who will say, oh, this all dates from Marbury v. Madison. Now, that is not true, something which is completely explained in my book, The Supremacist. Marbury v. Madison was not a decision of judicial supremacy. It was a division of judicial review. And it is true, if Congress passes an unconstitutional law, we do want the court to knock it down. But it was a very limited decision that respected the authority of the Constitution over the court as well as over the Congress. Really, the first decision of judicial supremacy was Dred Scott. And I think the reason the lawyers like to cite Marbury is that it is simply too embarrassing to cite Dred Scott, which was a really, it was a supremacist decision. The court did all kinds of things that it had no business doing, deciding issues that were not before the court, and declaring unconstitutional and perfectly constitutional law, which Congress had passed, banning slavery in the territories. Now, Abraham Lincoln had it right about the Dred Scott, and all you need to do is go read some of the famous debates and what he said about it. He said, under judicial review, we have to accept what the court did to poor old Dred Scott, but we do not have to accept it as the law of the land. And indeed, Lincoln did not accept it as the law of the land. Although the decision said blacks could not be citizens, Lincoln gave them passports and took other actions that only apply to citizens. And he said, we look forward to the day when it is overturned. Likewise, don't let anybody tell you that the minorities need that activist judge or court in order to protect their rights. Because if you take that position, they're stuck with Dred Scott, and they're stuck with Plessy v. Ferguson, which was a segregation case. They got their rights through constitutional amendments and through statutes that were passed by Congress. Now, the judicial supremacy, the activist judges, whom we are suffering from today, was not all through our system. The Dred Scott case was an aberration. What we see today is a takeover by the judiciary of the control of our government that has happened in our lifetime, or at least in the lifetime of some of us senior citizens who are here. Because it started with the regime of Chief Justice Earl Warren. And Earl Warren was a man who got his job as Chief Justice on a crooked political deal at the 1952 Republican National Convention, when he delivered the votes of the California delegation and got paid off with the promise of the first appointment to the Supreme Court. He had no judicial temperament. He had never been a judge. He was a man of no particular principles. When he ran for governor, he was nominated by both the Republican and the Democratic parties. So that tells you where he really stands, doesn't it? So he started out to make the court into the most powerful branch of government. And he was the first one to say in his decision, Cooper v. Aaron, that the Supreme Court decision is the supreme law of the land. Now, that is not good constitutional doctrine, but he said it. And the legal community picked it up and ran with it. And now they teach in all the law schools that whatever some judge says is the law of the land, and that the Constitution is whatever the Supreme Court says it is. Now, you can read the Constitution for yourself, and you know that is not true. So then he was assisted by his associate, Justice Brennan, who developed all these ideas about a living and evolving Constitution, and another associate, William Douglas, who said they would use the due process clause as the wild card so that they could basically make all kinds of policy and social and political and economic decisions. So this is what has been going on all these years, and it's been getting worse and worse and worse. Now, I can remember in the 1950s when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a whole series of pro-communist decisions. They dismantled the internal security of this country. And people were upset. Even the American Bar Association was upset and denounced him at their annual conventions. And the senators would have speeches on the Senate floor talking about Red Monday after Red Monday. And we were talking about doing something about the court then, but the court stopped handing down pro-communist decisions, and all of that died out. But the court did not give up its power. And then in the 1960s, I can remember the prayer decision came down. It was widely denounced by all the school people, by Dean Griswold of the Harvard Law School, and everybody was denouncing it. And yet, the court pulled back a little bit, but they didn't give up their power. And now we see how they've been grabbing more and more power all the way. Now, the Founding Fathers gave us a country of separation of powers, and the whole idea is, in this interlacing system of checks and balances, the other branches are supposed to rise to cut back when one branch gets too powerful. And the power is right there in the Constitution for the Congress to cut back on the authority of the court. The Constitution did not create any federal courts except a Supreme Court. All the other courts are created by Congress. And whatever Congress created, it can uncreate or abolish or regulate. And in addition to making regulations and exceptions to cases that the Supreme Court can hear. And Congress should use that power and assert its power against the activist judges. In my book, I give a whole history of how the court, of how the Congress has withdrawn jurisdiction from the federal courts over many issues and decided what kinds of cases they can hear and can't hear. And as a matter of fact, Senator Daschle got a law passed by Congress which said that the courts cannot hear cases about brush clearing in South Dakota, because he didn't want any environmentalist lawsuits interfering with the way they have fires and clean up the brush in South Dakota. Nobody's challenged that law. And there was even a portion of the new Sensenbrenner Real ID law that passed last year that takes away jurisdiction over a certain area of that law. But last fall, we were very encouraged by the passage of the Aiken Bill to withdraw jurisdiction from the federal courts over the Pledge of Allegiance, and the Hostetler Bill to withdraw jurisdiction over the Defense of Marriage Act. A year ago, people were saying this couldn't be done. Those bills passed easily by nice majorities. Of course, they didn't go anywhere in the Senate, so we need to start from square one again. But I do urge that as the way to cut back on the court. It can be done by a simple majority, doesn't require a constitutional amendment, and there are many other pieces of legislation that the Congress can do in order to cut back on the activist judges. As President Bush said, we're not going to stand for it. Well, how are we going to show that we're not going to stand for it? We expect the Congress to use its authority to do that. Now, a lot of people think we need to be nervous about this matter of withdrawing jurisdiction from the court, but I would like to call to your attention the annual report issued just a few weeks ago by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Now, he talked about what's going on in the court and all of their needs and so forth. And then he took up the matter of criticisms of the court. And he talked about the president's power to appoint new judges, and that's fine. He agrees that, and the president should be able to appoint good constitutionalist judges. And we don't know if they'll get confirmed. We hope so, but he can certainly do that. However, that does not remedy the problem of the hundreds of federal judges who were appointed by Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Lyndon Johnson, and even some bad ones by Richard Nixon. It was a Richard Nixon judge who tried to throw out the Pledge of Allegiance. So we've got all these judges on the bench who are all going to be there for our lifetime. What are we going to do about that? So Justice Rehnquist said he took up the problem of impeachment. And he spends 3 pages saying why, oh, this is a terrible way to go. We don't think judges should be impeached for anything that they say in any opinions. And then he's had one sentence, which I'm going to read to you so I get it right. He said, there were several bills introduced in the last Congress that would limit the jurisdiction of the federal courts to decide constitutional challenges to certain kinds of government action. And that's all he said. He didn't say it was bad. He didn't say you shouldn't do it. He didn't say it was illegal or unconstitutional. He just hung it out there. Now, I'm not a mind reader. I don't know what he meant by that. I hope he was saying, Congress, boys, it's in your court. Go with it. Or maybe he was saying to the judges, you better shape up or you're going to lose some of your power. But it's out there. And I think that is the way Congress ought to go. There have been in some of these previous outbursts against the activist court, there was talk about this, but it didn't go anywhere because the legal community is so much opposed to cutting back on the power of the court. But the whole liberal movement in this country is depending on an activist jury to do for them what they cannot get Congress and the state legislatures to do. Every time I debate one of these gay activists, I say, your job is to go to the state legislature and get them to amend the law to the way you want to do it. But you know you can't do it. So they run to the activist judges to get them to overrule the social policy that's made by the legislature. We get down to the bottom line, which I believe that the issue before our country today is self-government. Are we going to be governed by our elected representatives whom we can fire when we don't like what they do? Or are we going to be ruled by a little group of non-elected, life-tenured judges who think they're better than us, who think they have the right to create new rights, to throw out laws that that the American people want and believe are right and just laws? And I don't think so. And I think that the courts have gone over the line, particularly on the issues that I've mentioned here today, which are so important to the culture of our country. So on the issue of self-government, use the powers that are in the Constitution to cut back on the idea of supremacist judges. As President Bush said, we're not going to stand for it, and now's the time for action. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Phyllis. We do have time for some questions. Let me remind all of you that we have Phyllis's book. It's for sale at a special price of $20, and she'll be staying here for a few minutes after our lecture to sign books for those of you who have them with you. Do we have questions? We'll start over here. Please wait until the microphone arrives, and give us your name, please, and your association.
Thank you, Mrs. Schlafly. I really enjoyed your talk, and thank you for coming to visit us.
Yeah, we cannot hear. That mic must not be on or not working, if we can get that.
Okay. Does it work now?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
First, just want to say thank you for coming to Heritage. I think we all enjoyed your talk. My name is Dan Geary, and I'm an intern here. And I just had a question about how you think the Supreme Court should go about ruling on matters related to the Bill of Rights, in particular how they pertain to states now, especially in light of yesterday's decision, in that the wording of the Eighth Amendment is no cruel and unusual punishment. And do you still think the court has a prerogative to set that definition of what cruel and unusual actually means for states?
I think yesterday's decision was way out of line. There's no question but that cruel and unusual punishment did not mean what Justice Kennedy yesterday said it means. And I think Justice Thomas had it right. I heard him say that when a judge is confronted with a dilemma or controversy, he should look at the Constitution and say, does the Constitution authorize it or does the Constitution forbid it? And then he has his answer. And if he doesn't do that, then he looks himself inside himself and decides, what do I think about it, and what am I going to rule for everybody else? And they shouldn't be doing that. I think the decision about capital punishment for juveniles is a state legislative matter. I think about half the states allow it and half don't. And I think that's where it should be left. And the idea of the court coming along and saying, well, we decided that since other countries do it this way, we should make it a national rule.
Okay, yes, right here in the middle.
Thank you very much. Clark Neely with the Institute for Justice. I think there's probably a lot of agreement in this room that if courts really did look honestly at a law and ask whether it's constitutionally permissible or not, about 80% of the federal government would go away. because it's possible for a congressman to be activist as well. And unfortunately, Congress and by and large the Supreme Court has essentially ignored very clear textual limitations on congressional power for about the last 70 years. Is it a proper role, in your view, for courts to enforce textual limits on power in addition to enforcing rights that people have?
Well, I agree with Justice Scalia. We should stick to the text of the Constitution, and if you want to change it, there are procedures for changing it. But the judges are not part of the process. If you have a particular example, maybe we could address that.
About the Endangered Species Act.
The Endangered Species Act.
Well, there's nothing about endangered species. There's nothing in Article 1 of the Constitution that says Congress has power over endangered species.
Well, that's probably the extension of the Commerce Clause, and I don't know if the endangered species get into the Commerce Clause. I don't know. The Commerce Clause is pretty specific in the Constitution about giving the power to Congress. I don't know how they can approve some of these treaties and agreements that are made that give the power over commerce to foreign bodies. So
yes.
Todd Gazziano here at Heritage, and thank you again for the courage of your conviction over all these years. And I certainly, you know that I certainly support you in exploring and want to get Congress engaged in reasserting its role. And it occurred to me after you and I last spoke, there's a new opportunity. Actually, it was my colleague that Paul Rosenzweig that suggested it for Congress to respond to the death penalty case in addition to those other bills you mentioned. It seems here that Congress, and I'd like you to comment on this, could say if the decision is based on what the national standard of decency is, which is what Kennedy claimed to say he was striking down these laws, that the representative of the people, the Congress, should establish that national standard, and they ought to pass a resolution, a new law, that says, no, we as representative of the people establish the national policy. And for terrorism involving children, 16, 17-year-olds, it is not indecent to execute known terrorists, and it is a matter for the states. Do you think, how would the court react? Do you think that that is a new opportunity to kind of challenge them?
I do think you are maybe getting a little dangerous ground there because, of course, it was a state law that was involved in the case yesterday, and we do think that criminal law is mostly a state law. Perhaps Congress could do it in regard to the laws that are the crimes that have now been made federal crimes. I don't know what the court would do, but what I do think Congress ought to do is to get up and make speeches denouncing the decision. I am a believer we have to raise the level of public awareness and have people know that it is okay and part of our freedom of speech to criticize the court and to say that they're wrong and they're out of line and they're unconstitutional. And Congress could do, I would favor any type of move like that. I don't know if it'll get through, but I think talk would be very helpful. I hope the Congress, the Constitution, and the court subcommittees will be having hearings all the time. They could have hearings every week about the mischief of the courts and not run out of things to talk about or people to talk about it for the next year. And my book has a number of other suggestions. Another way Congress can proceed, while they cannot reduce the salary of a federal judge, they can certainly cut their budget and cut off all their perks. Maybe they could cut off their travel allowance to go to these foreign meetings. There are all kinds of things they could do. There was a bill in Congress last year that didn't go anywhere to say if the Ten Commandments monument were thrown out, that there no money could be spent to throw it out. So there are many ways that Congress can go, and I'm in favor of all kinds of actions.
Yes, let's go back here, and then we'll come down to the front.
Hi, John Richardson with Landmark Legal. Thank you for focusing on the issue. I've got mainstream media, and certainly the left claims the mantra that the court is conservative, more conservative than 20 years ago. And yet, and they point to the fact that it's dominated by Republican appointees. How do you, can you comment on the method we can use to focus attention on the court as an activist group, independent of the fact that they're Republicans? That just because they're Republicans doesn't mean that they respect the Constitution.
Well, you're right, and saying the court is conservative is just absurd. But you're right, they say it all the time. The majority of the Supreme Court justices were appointed by Republicans. The one time they asked Eisenhower if he ever made any mistakes while he was president, and he says yes, too, and they're both sitting on the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, Reagan and Bush 1 made those mistakes, too. It's just, it's very unfortunate. So it is not a conservative court. Although, as you see, most of them were appointed by Republicans, so that's no guarantee. That's why I think we should put some strictures on the kinds of cases they can hear. What was the other part of your question?
Did we have a question down here? Right down here, please. Then we'll move back to the back again and across the room.
Thank you. Matthew Spaulding here at the Heritage Foundation. The system you described is three branches, each having a equal say in the meaning of the Constitution, but of course outside of that stands the Constitution. And the method the founders put in the Constitution to allow that kind of discussion was through the amendment process. One of the great things you did for our country, of course, was almost single-handedly stopping a bad amendment. Given that experience and given where we are today with the court, do you think the mechanism of constitutional amendment is a legitimate process that still has a function in our politics, especially as it might cause a national debate on these exact issues? Do you think it's possible to amend the Constitution to correct some of these things?
Well, it's certainly possible to amend the Constitution, and a national debate on some of these issues is good. And I think part of our problem is the need to raise public awareness. And when I wrote my book, I laid out a lot of remedies, none of which require a constitutional amendment, because that is a long and difficult process. And I think we need faster action. As this decision yesterday shows, we need people to act now. They're really getting out of hand. And we need to do something before public disaffection with the court dissipates. And let me say also that I know there are some of you here from legal societies or some of these wonderful organizations that are joining cases and battling in the courts, and that's wonderful. I wrote my book for the average person who isn't a lawyer. I think, as I presented today, these are common sense issues that anybody can understand. I've done over 300 interviews on this book, and while the talk show hosts are relatively sympathetic, they don't know how to ask a question. And we need to raise public awareness of the problem and to understand that they can do something about it. So that's why my book is a handbook for action. So really, to answer your question, is anything. I mean, I'm for trying everything to make people understand that we do not want to be ruled by judges. We want to be governed by our elected representatives, whom we can really tell what's what when they do what we don't like.
All right, we've got a question right here, and then we're going to go over. I see Congressman Franks has his hand up, so we'll get to him next.
Phyllis Tom Smith with America 21. Back in 1999, Tom Kennedy held hearings in the Constitutional Subcommittee about the Congress versus the courts, and he pointed out what you did, that this court assumed that they had authority over the other two branches as late as 1958 in Aaron versus Cooper. But they also pointed out that 8 out of 10 Americans believe that to be the case in our system. What should Congress do to take back or to annul that raw assumption of power by the Supreme Court?
Well, you're right. It is, first of all, a raw assumption of power, and secondly, it has become CW, conventional wisdom. People believe it. And the purpose of my book is to show you that it isn't true, and it's not constitutional doctrine. And I think I've presented it in a way that anybody can understand. And what can Congress do? I think they ought to have hearings all the time. There are all kinds of people they can bring in to testify and let the American people know what the courts have done to us, because practically any issue you name, everything from crime to taxes to elections to abortion to Ten Commandments to marriage, the judges are the problem. And we need to have people understand this.
Congressman Franks.
Well, first of all, Phyllis, you know, I just would echo the general consensus here that you have given many great messages to America, but I don't think you've ever given a more seminal or more critical one than this. And I want you to know that I think you're absolutely dead on target, that it is the water on the inside of the ship that sinks it rather than the water on the outside, and that we have to set our court straight. And I'm just hoping that perhaps out of this meeting can come a general feeling that we're dedicated to moving forward with this, that Heritage might join with a few of us in the Congress to put together some materials that we can present on the floor that reflect the principles that Phyllis has laid out here. And I just suggest to you that if we fail to do that, 1,000 generations, if America's around that long, will suffer greatly. And I just believe that everything that our founding fathers fought for, the revolution, rule of law, the republic itself is at stake here. So it's worth the effort. And I want to thank you, m'lady. The history will be very kind to you when they look back at what you've done here.
Well, thank you very much, Congressman. I want to say that my book has a number of other suggestions that Congress can do. For example, Congress should repeal the law that allows the ACLU to collect attorney's fees when they have these Pledge of Allegiance and Ten Commandments cases. That law only was passed in 1976. It was a Watergate-era law. And Congress should address that and make sure that the law for attorney's fees does not apply to challenges to the acknowledgement of God under the Establishment Clause. Another thing Congress could do, we have the case of a single federal judge who's thrown out a whole referendum, like it was one Jimmy Carter appointed judge who threw out Prop 187 in California, voted for by 5 million people to deny taxpayer benefits to illegal aliens. And there never was any real adjudication of this. One judge put it in the bottom drawer and forgot about it and overruled 5 million people. Now, Congress could decide that that can't be done except by a panel of at least three judges. That's one thing. It would be very easy for Congress to do. So there are all kinds of remedies that Congress can take. The only thing they can't do is lower their pay, but you can do everything else. You're going to abolish the court.
All right. We're going to take one last question, and this lady right here. And let me just say, Congressman, I think my colleagues at the Heritage Foundation would be very delighted to work with you on some things to put forward in the Congress. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Sheila Riley, and I'm from Spotsylvania, Virginia. Unfortunately, the home of the 12-year-old brat with the Pledge of Allegiance case. I wanted to say that in Florida, we've got an excellent case of what you're talking about, and that would be where we had state legislator down there pass Terry's law specifically to save Terry Schindler Schiavo's life, and you've got a judge who ruled it unconstitutional, even though it was passed when the state legislator was signed in law by the governor. You've now got Judge Greer down there who keeps throwing out, won't read things, admits in court. He hasn't read sworn testimony, hasn't read 30, 40, 50 neurologist reports, and yet has signed a death warrant now. But yesterday, the Supreme Court throws out that we can't put to death mass murderers. I guess if Terry was 17, maybe they would save her. How can we, in cases like that where the Supreme Court won't hear the case?
Well, that's a big problem. That's the problem. The Supreme Court does duck a lot of cases they just don't want to hear. And you are right to compare Terry's case with the 17-year-old criminal. You can also say, how can they say that a 12-year-old girl is mature enough to decide to kill her unborn baby, but this 17-year-old vicious criminal didn't know what he was doing when he carried out this murder for kicks that is so terrible. It's you're trying to develop some type of consistency? No, it doesn't work that way. They think whatever they say is the law of the land, and that's what we have to make the American people understand is not true.
Well, thank you very much, Phyllis, once again. Many thanks. Thanks to all of you for being here today. Please don't forget to get a copy of your book. Phyllis will be here signing. Thanks to our internet watchers. And remember, this will be archived if you have other people who need to hear Phyllis's message. Thank you very much. There are refreshments outside.